So we're moving on from the deductive argument, which says that it's impossible for God to exist with evil. We've seen that that's actually been solved. Now we're moving on into the inductive argument, which says that it's just highly, highly improbable that God would coexist with evil. Now, that's different. That's not saying it's impossible. It's just saying looking out at the abundance of evil and suffering in the world, isn't this strong evidence that there is no such thing as a good and loving God? It doesn't mean it's impossible, just that it's improbable. Here's the way Michael Martin describes it in his book, Atheism: A Philosophical Justification. Look at what he admits here on page 335. Because of the failure of deductive arguments from evil, atheologians, atheists, have developed inductive or probabilistic arguments from evil for the non-existence of God. He's just flat out admitting that deductive arguments, types of arguments, fail. We've hit a brick wall after Plantinga wrote his book. Now we're getting into the inductive case that it's highly, highly, extraordinarily improbable that a good and all-powerful God would exist with evil. An inductive argument does not try to eliminate the possibility of God. Instead, it simply tries to eliminate the probability of God. So I'll give you an inductive argument. Premise one, 75% of people living in Dublin, Ireland are Catholic. Premise two, O'Connor lives in Dublin, Ireland. Therefore, the conclusion, O'Connor is an Irish Catholic. Now, does that mean that O'Connor must be Irish Catholic if he lives in Dublin? No, it's not certain. It's not absolutely logically certain. It's just an inductive argument. It's just it's likely the case that O'Connor is Irish Catholic. Here's the way Bertrand Russell describes it. This is actually a really interesting illustration. This is from Why I'm Not a Christian. He says, supposing you got a crate of oranges that you opened, and you found all the top layer of oranges bad, you would not argue the underneath ones must be good so as to redress the balance. So you pull a crate of oranges off the truck, you open it up, and all the top oranges are just disgusting and rotted, and there's fruit flies flying out. Just looking at the top, you would never think, well, the bottom ones are probably good. Russell writes, you would probably say, probably the whole lot is a bad consignment. And that is really what a scientific person would argue about the universe. He would say, here we find in this world a great deal of injustice. And so far as that goes, that is a reason for supposing that justice does not rule in the world. He's not saying it's impossible for God to exist in the presence of evil. He's just saying it's highly unlikely. So an inductive argument doesn't make God impossible. It just makes him highly improbable. Well, our answer to this is going to be a little bit complicated. I'm just going to go through the entire biblical narrative from beginning to end in about 2 hours. That's all it's going to take. We're going to describe the Bible's solution. I don't want to just give this from a philosophical perspective, but what the Bible actually states as its own answer for the problem of evil. Okay? Now, the inductive problem of evil works pretty well against what Richard Swinburne calls a bare God, which means that you just have a God who's all loving, all powerful, all good. Okay, it would be hard for that God to exist with the world. But if you add in all of the extra facts that we know about God from the Bible, such as the cross, such as the origin of evil, such as the end of evil, and such as all the other particulars that are described in Scripture, that God is not improbable in the presence of evil. So we can think about it from another perspective. Let's say I gave you an inductive argument that 90% of college students drink beer. Joe is a college student. Therefore, Joe drinks beer. Pretty good inductive argument. Doesn't mean it's certain, just means it's probable. Now, that would be true, but what if I told you that Joe was a freshman at Brigham Young University? That would change the probability, wouldn't it? At Brigham Young University, 90% of the students do not drink beer, or maybe 100%. I don't know how strict they are, but it's part of their rules. You cannot drink alcohol if you're a student at Brigham Young. So knowing that background information about Joe, that would completely change the probability of that inductive argument. In the same way, while just a bare, restricted God might be highly improbable in the presence of evil, if we add in all of these background points, all of this background information about who God is, about how evil originated, about how it will end, and about what God's doing now, that could actually change 180 degrees the probability of God existing. So we're going to frame our answer to the inductive problem in this way. We're going to defend the biblical view on the beginning of evil and the end of evil, and then we're going to bring that together toward the middle of evil. Because that's how the Bible describes it. It gives us the two bookends, and then it lets us work our way into our current present situation. Or to put that another way, the Christian can look to the past, to what God has done, and believe what he's saying in the future so that he can live or she can live currently in the present. Well, let's begin at the beginning. Let's start with the beginning of evil. The Bible teaches that evil came into the world not through God, but through the free-willed choice of the first human beings on earth. Therefore, it wasn't God who willed evil. It was God created perfect human beings who made a free choice to bring evil and suffering into the world of their own volition, not God's volition. Okay, that being said, that's the biblical answer. Somebody will come back and say, well, how could the moral fall, what you just said, be true if we know that pain and death existed for millennia before the fall? You know, when we look back at the fossil record, we see animal death. I mean, the whole idea of predation did not begin at the moral fall. That's been going back for eons, millions of years. And so how can we harmonize those two things? Here's the way Michael Martin describes it. He says, we know from science that the conditions and causes of human hardship, disease, death, and other natural evils existed before the emergence of human beings, hence before human beings first sinned. So how can you say that the first humans brought evil and suffering into the world if humanity only began here and everything behind it already had pain and death and destruction? Well, the first thing we can point out is that the Bible actually teaches that pain existed before the fall. Yes, it does. God must have called pain very good in his summation of his creation in Genesis 1:31. In Genesis 3:16, when God gives his curse to Eve, he says that your pain in birth will be multiplied. Multiplied. If her pain was zero, if there was no pain, multiplying that wouldn't affect it at all. Multiplying it only matters if there was pain to begin with. If he said, your pain's going to be multiplied, why didn't she just come back and say, what's pain? I've never experienced pain before. Instead, pain must have existed before the fall ever took place. Instead, it was being increased. Pain was probably designed as a defense mechanism in the first humans. We can also point out that human death began at the fall, not animal death. The Bible does not teach that animal death began at the fall, only human death. Now, some people point to Isaiah 65:25, where it says that the wolf and the lamb will graze together, or the lion will lay down with the lamb. There's a problem with using that verse to describe pre-fall. It's because this verse isn't describing pre-fall. It's describing the end of human history. It's not referring to the past. It's referring to the future. Well, somebody will say, well, yeah, in the future, when God restores all of creation, it will be like it was before the fall. But there's a problem with saying that. The Bible never makes that connection. It never makes that assertion. In fact, at the end of human history, in Isaiah 25, verse 6, we read that God's going to give us the finest wines and the choicest marrow, choicest meats. So apparently animals will be getting killed at that time. Other people will point to Genesis 9:3, where God says that all the creatures on the earth will be food for you. And they say, see, that's the first time anyone got to kill another animal. Well, that's not what that passage is saying. It's speaking about God's provision for Noah and his family, not his sanction. That's not a moral command. It's a provision. He's describing what's been provided for him. In fact, two chapters earlier in Genesis 7:2, Noah is able to differentiate between clean and unclean animals, which implies that they were being killed long before God gave some kind of supposed sanction. Still other people will say, well, Romans 5:12-21 states that in Adam, death was brought into the world. And so in Christ, redemption will come through Christ. Well, there's a problem using that verse, because that verse does not speak about animal death. It speaks about human death. Are we saying that animals are allowed to receive Christ and be redeemed as a result of Romans 5? Well, of course not. Sorry for all you pet owners, but that's not what Paul had in view in Romans 5. He wasn't speaking about the animal kingdom. He was speaking about how humans began to die and how humans can find eternal life through Christ. When we flip over into Psalm 104, which is a commentary on the creation described in Genesis 1 and 2, we see that the commentator, the psalmist, describes the original creation by including predation, predators killing prey. He says in verse 21, the young lions roar after their prey and seek their food from God. According to the psalmist, there was no problem with animals feeding on other animals at creation. That was from God. God created that. You know, let's think about this picture here. This is from Jurassic Park. We know that the Tyrannosaurus Rex existed, right? Now look at that thing. We have to ask ourselves, were the T-Rex's teeth designed for eating plants? Plant life? No, they were designed for eating Jeff Goldblum, okay? That thing is a predator. It was not meant to be a vegetarian. It was an omnivore, a carnivore. I mean, it was supposed to go after other mammals. So just by looking out at nature, we should just assume that there were species that were designed to be predators. We can also point out that pain and death could exist in a very good world. Okay, we need plant and animal death in order to have fossil fuels, fertile soil. I mean, if we got rid of predation, if we got rid of animal and plant death, you know, how could we possibly have a world that could be habitable? Hugh Ross's point is that actually it was probably God's kindness, it was his mercy to allow this, because in animal populations that are starving, you usually bring in game wardens to thin out the herd. It's actually a kind thing to do. Otherwise, the animals just starve to death. And without predation, without animals preying on other animals, we would have animals that were just starving to death. But you're probably asking yourself the question, wait a minute. So for millions of years, animals were killing animals? There was animal suffering going on? You know, just think of all the different animals that would have been killed. Millions upon billions of animals. Well, that's considered a very good world, according to God, Genesis 1:31. Well, there's an interesting book that just came out in 2009. It's by Michael Murray. He's a Christian philosopher. The name of the book is Nature Red in Tooth and Claw. And in the book, Murray makes the argument that while animals can feel pain, while animals can suffer, they do not experience third-order pain. You're wondering, what is third-order pain? Third-order pain is not just the thought or the notion of pain, suffering. It's the thought or the notion, I am in pain. It takes a conscious being to be able to say consciously, I am in pain. And animals do not have the hardware to be able to consciously state, I am in pain. So God, in his unfathomable mercy, didn't put the prefrontal cortex in any other species except for advanced primates. We're the only ones with the hardware that is able to produce consciousness. So while animals do have the experience of pain, 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 they recoil at pain. I mean, if you have an animal and you care about them and you see them in pain, it hurts to see that. It might actually be that you are the conscious one feeling for them rather than them actually being the ones able to say, I am in pain. It's called an anthropopathism. It's when we apply human attributes to things that aren't human. Like anytime you see a Disney movie and the bunny has big, beautiful eyes and a very sincere look on their face and it talks and hops around like a personal being. That's an anthropopathism. That's where we're applying human attributes to something that doesn't have it. And animals, likewise, do not have third-order pain. If you're interested in that, I suggest to pick up the book. It's fascinating reading. Okay, somebody else will point out, wait a minute. Did humanity really begin with two naked, sinless people? I mean, we really believe that there were two humans, and those are the first ones created? Well, we can point out, first, that Jesus and the New Testament authors certainly thought so. Luke 3:38 connects the historicity of Adam, the first human, with the historicity of Jesus. The reality of Adam was exactly the same as Jesus. Romans 5:12, Paul compares Adam's fall as just as historical as Christ's cross and redemption. In Paul's mind, those two people were equally as historical. Matthew 19:4, Jesus taught that the first humans were, quote, male and female. He believed this story. Moreover, Paul in 1 Timothy 2 and 2 Corinthians 11 thinks that Eve is likewise just as historical as Adam. So what we're really saying here is the New Testament authors who were inspired apparently believed that this was history. This was not allegory. This was not mythology. This was history. This is real space-time history. In fact, the story of Genesis is written as history. There's no point in Genesis where it shifts from poetry and allegory into history. It's the same exact genre of literature from beginning to end. It's not like there's a point where it goes from mytho-poetry into space-time reality. The same expression, these are the generations of, in Hebrew, is used throughout the entire book. Well, this being said, there was a story of Norman Geisler. He went to a gathering of scholars, and he went up to a very highly critical scholar who apparently said that he was a Christian. He said he believed in God and believed in Christ. And yet Geisler knew that this guy denied the historicity of Adam and Eve. Thought that was all mythology, allegory, kind of like a parable, maybe something like that. And so Geisler went up and talked to him, and they had a long conversation. And at some point in the conversation, Geisler said, well, what do you do with Jesus and Paul and the other New Testament authors all claiming that these were real historical people? And the scholar turned back to him and said, well, I know more about the Old Testament than Jesus did. Jesus was just a first century rabbi, Palestinian Jew. I'm a modern scholar. I went to a Ivy League school. Well, if you're saying that, I guess he's right. I guess he's saying if he doesn't believe in the historicity of Adam and Eve, then he's basically saying, I know more than Jesus did. I know more than Paul did. Well, that being said, I think there's some other cases, other reasons why we can view these first couple chapters of Genesis as historical. We can point out that actually Genesis gets a lot of things right that are often overlooked. For example, Genesis teaches that the early humans were primitive, not civilized. You ever thought about that? I mean, how different would the story be if it taught that humans lived in some kind of like space age, you know, really advanced society, and then they fell and then they became primitive after that? No. Genesis reads just like space-time history. It says that the first humans, they had to learn about raising animals. They learned how to make tents, make music, make metal. I mean, they had to learn all these things. They were primitive. Genesis also teaches that humans were the last species to be created. course, modern biology agrees with this. What if it said that humans were created on day one and then all the species were created after that? That would be a major problem. Instead, the opening chapter of Genesis describes a space-time account of how God created. Now, it's not an exhaustive account. It's not like a modern blow-by-blow of biology textbook or anything like that. But what we have there is kind of a general account, and at the very end, it says humans were created last. Well, Paul Ehrlich, he's a professor of biology at Stanford University. He says that the production of a new animal species in nature has yet to be documented. I don't think anybody here would disagree with that. Humans came last, and Genesis gets that right. Moreover, Genesis teaches that human beings began in the correct general area of the world. The leading theory today on the origin of Homo sapiens is the out of Africa theory. They place it in East Africa. Okay? The Bible places the origin of humanity in the Fertile Crescent between the Tigris and the Euphrates. It's right there. I mean, think about how different it would be if it said that first humans were created, you know, in North America or in Australia. It actually places humans right in the exact place, or at least really, really close to where modern biology and anthropology agrees. I can also point out a fact I just learned recently. There's that part in Genesis 2 where it talks about the four different rivers that God created. Now, it mentions the Tigris and the Euphrates. You know, not that big of a deal. Okay, the Tigris and the Euphrates were still around in Moses' time, 3,500 years ago. But if you read the Genesis account, one of the things you notice is that there's not much information given for the Tigris and the Euphrates. You ever notice that? It's almost as if Moses knew his audience was familiar with those two rivers. The Tigris and Euphrates were mentioned, and they were around at that time. But then it gives the details for two rivers, the Pishon and the Gihon, that are not known. They're not known to us today. They weren't known to Moses back then. Well, what's interesting is Moses gives additional details for the Pishon and the Gihon. He says that they're in the land of Havilah, which is modern day Arabia. And he says that there's much gold found there where these two rivers are. Well, for years, critics of the Bible looked at that passage and they thought, OK, well, he gets the Tigris and the Euphrates right, but he made up these other two completely. This is mythology, obviously. What's interesting is back in 1994, a spaceship looked down at this general area of the world. OK, and it took a test from space and it could only take a little tiny little square from space. OK. And it's shot right in modern day Arabia in the desert. Well, because it's very dry, the test could actually shoot down very low. And what they discovered was an ancient river that had dried up probably 6,000 years ago, long before the time of Moses. And it was flowing right through the land of Havilah in modern day Arabia. Moreover, the British mined gold from this particular location back during colonial times. So from that, we can infer this is not mythology. This is not allegory. It's not La La Land like the other mythopoetic allegories found in other religions. This is talking about real space-time events, mentioning specific details. Well, we can also point out, in response to this objection, that it's highly difficult to prove the moral nature of the first humans. How could you scientifically prove if the first humans were created moral, morally perfect or immoral? This would be like proving the heartache of an ancient king or the anxiety of an ancient leader. How could you prove that? We're talking about prehistory here. The Bible has no qualms about saying what we're talking about in the garden is long before anything has ever been recorded. It's prehistory. We're going back thousands of years. Well, they call it prehistory for a reason. There's no other documentation at this time, and yet we're getting this information from the Creator who claims to have been there himself. It's revelation. Moreover, we can point out that we can directly perceive the effects of the fall. While we can't perceive the fall directly, we can perceive the effects of the fall. This would be like going down into the deep south It's bad enough in the cities, but when you get out into the boondocks, you will see some of the most grotesque things. Racism is alive and well. No joke about it. Well, what if somebody said the Civil War never happened? We never tried to enslave African Americans in this country. Well, we can directly perceive the results of that even today. Now, that's not the only possible explanation, but we're saying we're taking this historical data that was passed on to us, and we're placing faith in that, and we're lining that up with the world that we actually see. Yeah, I do believe that racism is in the South because of a lot of the strife that happened at the end of the 19th century. In the same way, we can directly perceive the effects of the moral fall as well. You know, how many times have you heard this expression? It's not the way it's supposed to be. We look out at the world and we say, it's not the way it's supposed to be. You know, ask yourself, is there something about the world that you find wrong? Just one thing. I mean, murder, genocide. Is there anything on earth you find to be wrong? If you say yes, then you're comparing this world to a perfect world. It might be that you're actually instilled to think about the way things should be perfectly. Okay, well, somebody else can point out, wait a minute, we're still on the beginning of evil. Isn't it unfair that the human race would be judged for the sin of two people? Okay, maybe the first humans brought sin into the world, but now we are judged for what they chose? Michael Martin describes it in this way. He says it's grossly unjust to punish the descendants of the first pair of human beings because this first pair sinned against God. If God did this, then he must be unjust. Atheist Walter Sinnott Armstrong of Duke University writes this. He says, almost everyone agrees that group punishment is barbaric. You should not be punished for what your father or your state's governor did, especially if they did it before you were born. Why not? Because their acts were beyond your control, and it's unfair to punish people for what they couldn't control. This widely accepted principle of justice would be violated by punishing babies for original sin. You see what he's saying? I mean, isn't it unfair that God would allow us to be judged for what the first humans did? Well, in response, we can say that this is actually a false assumption. This is not what the Bible teaches. It does not teach that we're punished for what the first humans did. Instead, the Bible teaches that we received Adam's nature, his sin nature. We did not receive his guilt. We're not punished for what he did, even though we are affected by what he did. While it is true that human beings all inherited a sin nature, we're judged for our own sin. We are judged for no one else's sin except for our own. You know, in Matthew 16, Jesus teaches that we'll be judged deed for deed. Romans 2:6, same thing. Ezekiel 18 is an interesting passage. I won't read it, but it comes in the context of the Jews cursing out God for being exiled by him. And they're asking God, is it right that the sins of our fathers would get us exiled from the land? Why would the sins of our fathers, why should we be paying for their sin? And in reply, in Ezekiel 18, 19 and 20, God tells them, you're not going to be sinned for what your father did. You're going to be judged for what you have done. No, I will not take out the sins of your father onto you. Now, Exodus 20 says that the wrath of God will persist to the third and fourth generation. That must be referring to social sin. Okay, meaning if my father is an alcoholic, there is a higher probability that I will be an alcoholic. If my dad was abusive to my mom, there's a high probability I would be abusive. So in that sense, sin is social. We can affect other people, but we will not be judged for what other people have done. We're judged for our own sin, not for the sin of somebody else. That being said, we can point out that if God didn't allow us to affect other people. Okay, so somebody would say, all right, so we're not judged for what Adam and Eve did. We're judged for ourselves. But why do we even get their sin nature? Why wouldn't God just insulate them off and we could all make our own choice? Well, there's a problem with that. You know, think about the movie I Am Legend with Will Smith. Okay. In the movie, Will Smith drives at incredible speeds in one of the sexiest cars you've ever seen, okay, through the city of New York. He's got his gun out. He's just shooting wildly into the buildings. There's one scene where he's on an aircraft carrier and he's just driving balls into the glass buildings. He's breaking into people's apartments. He's stealing their stuff. Now, would anyone here consider any of those actions immoral? Of course not. Why not? Well, he's affecting things, but there's no people around. It's impossible to be moral, to be a moral agent, to exercise morality in the absence of persons. You need people in order to be moral. Okay? So in that case, now if there was people populating New York City, then Will Smith would be immoral at that point. But because he's all alone, you know, going through and wrecking objects, that's not moral or immoral. Well, the Bible teaches that we, you and I, are personal beings made in God's image. Okay. If God did not allow us to affect one another, if he put a big insulated bubble around each person and we couldn't affect each other, well, that would mean at that point we would be subpersonal. We would not be exercising our personhood at all. I mean, think about the concept of solitary confinement. This is one of the worst punishments you can be given in the United States. Some people say after being in solitary confinement for a couple days at a time, your mind starts to snap. You ever seen that movie Shawshank Redemption where they put Andy down in the hole for, I think it's like 3 months, 2 months or something? And he's just losing it. He's losing his mind down there. This view, the idea that we wouldn't be able to affect each other, that would be the same as solitary confinement. I hope you realize that. You'd be disconnected from other personal agents, and God is not in that business. God created us to be personal and to be able to affect each other. Otherwise, it'd be horribly lonely and dull. What about natural evil? Okay, we've already pointed out that such things as disease, tornadoes, hurricanes, tsunamis, earthquakes, none of these things began at the advent of the human race. They go back millions of years, billions. Since the earth existed, these things were occurring. So how can we really say that the beginning of evil began by human free will if these things preceded human choice and human freedom? Here's the way Walter Sinnott Armstrong describes it. He says, even if the value of free will did explain why God allows evil that is caused by humans, it still would not explain why God allows natural evil. The free will defense does not apply to natural evil. Well, in response to this objection, I think a few points can be made. First, natural disasters are actually necessary for human life. So to call these things evil is really a misnomer. We really shouldn't call these things evil. Perhaps the effects are evil or something like that, but the disasters in and of themselves are not evil. For example, if we did not have a molten core in the planet Earth, okay, we wouldn't have earthquakes. That would be nice. But the problem is, if we didn't have a molten core, there would be no magnetosphere around the Earth, which protects us from radiation bombardment. So if it took care of one problem, it would create another. What about electromagnetic radiation? Well, if we didn't have electromagnetic radiation, that would be nice. But then on the other hand, we wouldn't have nuclear fusion, and then thus we wouldn't have any burning stars. Well, if we didn't have floods, that would be nice. If we didn't have floods, that would be terrific. We wouldn't have people dying en masse. Then again, we wouldn't have land that had effective silt and essential minerals for growing crops. So if you solve one problem, you can see it just creates another. If we didn't have lightning, people wouldn't be getting struck to death 10 times a year. Then again, we wouldn't have nitric oxide in the rain for plants. Plant life wouldn't grow. Okay, if we had no hurricanes and typhoons, well, how would we solve that? Well, hurricanes and typhoons are created because the sun unevenly heats the earth. That's where hurricanes and typhoons come from. So with changing weather patterns and changing pockets of heat and cold, when they collide, That's what eventually creates hurricanes and typhoons. So you could eliminate that problem by having three suns. If you had one sun that heated the equator and then two suns on each pole of the Earth, that would evenly heat the entire globe and we wouldn't have hurricanes and typhoons. The only problem is if we had three suns, that would completely destroy the planet in the process. That wouldn't help. So we would have a roasted planet. At least we wouldn't have hurricanes and typhoons. So the whole point there is, well, somebody could say, well, couldn't God have created a planet where there could be three suns and yet it wouldn't roast the Earth, or a molten core that wouldn't create earthquakes? We can always push things back a step, but I'm sure you can see that the problem is not that easy. It's not like we could just eliminate natural evil by the snap of the fingers. That this whole thing is brought into a cause and effect nexus, that if you disturb one part, it would disturb another. That being said, natural evil could result from free choice, not our free choice. It's not that the first humans created natural evil. Instead, the first humans threw themselves into a world, a violent world of cause and effect, and that was a free-willed decision. Well, there's two possibilities, theologically. The one possibility is that the Garden of Eden was supernaturally protected by God. So it'd be like a biodome, something like that. The first humans were in there apart from sin, apart from evil, apart from suffering. And they could look out. They could look out at the world that was violent and just chaotic around them. So this could have been extra incentive for them never to throw off God's protection. To be thrown out of the Garden of Eden would mean that you were being thrown out into a violent and chaotic world. And that would be a free will decision. You know, why is it that God created a garden? Why isn't it that just the entire planet wasn't the garden? Why a specified location? The other possibility is that the first humans had protected bodies, supernaturally protected bodies. You know, our resurrected bodies are going to be this way. In Acts 1:9, Jesus is in his resurrected body. He talks to his disciples, gives them the Great Commission, and then he takes off into the stratosphere. Now, do you think Jesus was up there choking because there wasn't enough air? I don't think so. There was a supernatural body. It's a resurrected body. So in this case, from this view, it could be that the first humans were supernaturally protected. That is, if a typhoon came through the garden, it would be like a roller coaster ride. It'd be a blast. Tornado, flood, you couldn't be harmed because you had a supernaturally protected body. Not a resurrected body, but something really powerful. Could be either or. In this sense, natural evil could go back to the first human decision to freely move against God, and they were throwing themselves into a cause and effect universe. Not that they created a cause and effect universe at all. Then we've got Jesus' teaching. Jesus taught in Luke 13 about natural and moral evil. He gives the example of the Tower of Siloam that fell over and killed a number of people. Then he gives the example of Pontius Pilate going through and morally, in an evil way, killing a bunch of people, a bunch of Galileans. Well, Jesus says, do you think that that was a result of those people's sin? That natural evil and that moral evil, both cases? He says, I tell you the truth, no. But if you do not repent, the same eventual problem is going to come to you. You're eventually going to die, maybe not that way, but a different way. In other words, Jesus was teaching that natural evil is a result of the fall. And actually, natural evil is a wake-up call to the fate that we're all going to experience, which is death. It's whether we go one way or another, we're all eventually going to end in death, according to Christ. And these events can be wake-up calls to show us that our time is short. We don't have forever to decide if we want a relationship with God. Of course, in John 9, the Pharisees, the religious leaders, were arguing over why a person was born blind. There was a Jewish man who was born blind. Well, there was two separate schools of thought. One party thought that the baby was born blind because of something that their parents had done. And so the sin was counted onto the little infant because of what their parents did. Another school of thought at the time in Palestine was that there was such a thing as fetal sin. There was sin you could commit inside the womb. I don't know what this would look like. I don't know where they came up with it. But apparently they thought it's something that that little infant did in the womb. And what does Jesus say? Does he say it was the sin of the parents that was passed down? Or was the sin of the kid while he was in the uterus? Jesus says it's neither. It's just that we're in a fallen world. And that's where natural evil, like disease or blindness, that's where it comes from. So we could say natural evil is the result of human sin in general, not human sin in particular. This is why the fundamentalist, kooky preacher is completely off base when they say that a natural event, like a tsunami or a flood or an earthquake, is the result of people's sin. Even Jesus didn't say that. That's completely off base. Not only is it cruel and unloving to say something like that, it's not biblical. It's not what the Bible teaches. I remember that was going around during the New Orleans flood, where they're saying, oh, New Orleans, Sin City, they were getting judged for their sin. What's interesting is the most sinful parts of New Orleans weren't flooded. It wasn't the places where a lot of, quote unquote, real, you know, gross sin was going on. It was the places where that wasn't happening. Completely backwards. That's why it's completely asinine and presumptuous to ever make a claim like that. We should never, ever say something like that. We could also point out that some natural evil could be the result of demonic activity. Now, by this, we do not want to venture into some kind of demonic paranoia. We've all met Christians that no matter what's going on, they think, oh, that's Satan. That's a demon doing that to you. We don't know that, okay? We don't know if there are spiritual forces at work or if it's just natural cause and effect. That's also at work, too. We don't know which one it is. But that being said, the Bible does say that some natural evil is the result of demonic activity. Without apologizing, Scripture teaches that there is a violent spiritual world around us where there are such things as unembodied spiritual beings who are violently against God. It's really not that big of a stretch. You and I, most people, believe in a soul or a spirit that animates our body. Okay, that we're not just physical beings, that there is a spiritual component to us as well. Demons or angels are unembodied spiritual beings, personal agents. They're exactly the same as us, only they are without a corporeal nature. They don't have a body. So it's really only one step away to say that there are such a thing as spiritual beings that are unembodied. And the Bible teaches this. In Job 1:16 through 2:7, you've got Satan talking about Job. And it says, Job, well, there is a group of people that came through and killed his family. And yet we know Satan was the one who inspired that because of his conversation with God. There's another example in Job where it says a violent wind came through and knocked over his house, killing members of his family. Well, violent winds are part of the natural order, and yet the Bible teaches that Satan was the one actually responsible for that. In addition to a cause and effect world, Satan could intervene. Then you've got the case of boils, natural evil, sickness, and yet Satan, a demonic figure, was responsible for that. Well, we read this in the New Testament as well. It says in Mark 9:20 that there was a person found sick, but it was because they were with a spirit. There's a spirit manipulating that. It's through the Bible. So I don't think we should be wacky about this. As Christians, we don't think everything is involved or caused by Satan or demons. Radical demonic paranoia is strange. We should not get into that. But we should leave this open as a possibility, because the Bible does. Moreover, we can point out that free will amplifies natural evil. You know, some natural evils, not all, could be a result of free choice. When somebody has a heart attack and they're morbidly obese, there was a free will decision that led to that. Not all heart attacks are a result of that. Of course not. That would be really cruel to say that it's your decision that you died. No, but sometimes there are some natural evils that we can trace back to a human decision. You know, the cigarette smoker who gets cancer. Clearly, there are some free will decisions that will have adverse effects on us. I'm not saying all, The Bible doesn't teach that, but clearly there is a correlation in some cases. Other people point out that our free-willed decisions in affecting our planet could also result in natural evil. Now, I know this is hotly debated. I know some people I'll talk to, when you talk to them about global warming and that sort of thing, they're like, absolutely, of course that exists. Other people you talk to, they're like, that's the biggest hoax, the biggest bunch of nonsense I've ever heard. I don't think the debate is really over the Earth getting warmer. I think that's clear. The debate from friends I've talked to is whether humans are responsible for the hydrocarbons, or if that's just we're in a stage of our planet's whatever, where it goes ebbs and flows. At least for some people, this point is persuasive. I know some people that would get in my face and chew me out for saying this, but the Bible teaches that humans are supposed to be responsible for our Earth, our planet, and breaking that covenant could result in natural evil as well. Definitely possible. But finally, we should point out that free will amplifies natural evil. Oftentimes, when we see natural evil occurring, it's not the natural evil that's the problem. Oftentimes, it's the free-willed agents that turn it into a much more grotesque problem. Remember seeing footage of the warlords in Haiti who were collecting and garnering all of the supplies, the food and medicine that was being sent down after the earthquake. You know, it wasn't even the earthquake in that case that was evil. It was the warlords who were hoarding supplies. In that case, they were amplifying natural evil, making it worse than it even could have been. Or the looting going on in New Orleans after the flood. Okay, there is natural evil, but in addition to that, we have human persons who are taking advantage of things when they shouldn't be. Okay, why didn't God create free-willed beings who only chose good? Why didn't God just create free-willed beings who only chose the good? Michael Martin says there would be no problem in creating a world in which humans were free and yet never did anything wrong. Walter Synod Armstrong describes it this way. He says, many murderers can be stopped without robbing them of their free will at all. Consider a pedophile who contacts young children on the internet, talks them into meeting him, then kidnaps them, rapes them, and kills them. What would God have to do to save the child? Just make this pedophile's computer crash right before he contacts little Mary. The pedophile would still have free will, but he would not cause as much pain and suffering. So why doesn't God foil evil plans or turn evil people into klutzes? Why wouldn't God just create a free-willed being who only chose the good? Or maybe God could stop them from doing what they wanted to do. Well, the first thing we can point out is that in the fundamental case that's being made, this is logically contradictory. Okay. Yes, it is impossible for God to create a logical contradiction. It has nothing to do with power. It's not because God's not powerful enough to do that. God cannot create a square circle. Well, he's not strong enough to do that? No, it's a logical contradiction. You can't possibly do it. Is God powerful enough to make 2 plus 2, 5? No, it's not about power. He just can't logically do that. That's impossible. Well, can God create a married bachelor? Can God create a universe where he himself doesn't exist? Can God create a stone so heavy that even he can't move it? No, those are all logical contradictions. The way that Homer Simpson put it on The Simpsons was, can God create a burrito so hot that even he can eat it? No. I mean, there's no possible way for God to create logical contradictions like this. Well, what are we saying when we say that we want God to create a free-willed agent whom he controls? We're saying we want God to create a logical contradiction. And no, he cannot do that. That's logically impossible. If he values free will, he cannot create a free-willed agent that he's going to control and override. Here's the way Lewis puts it in The Problem of Pain. He says, by saying that God can give a creature free will and at the same time withhold free will from it, you have not succeeded in saying anything about God. Meaningless combinations of words do not suddenly acquire meaning simply because we prefix to them the two other words, God can.
kind of a funny way of putting it. We're just going to make a bunch of nonsense and we're going to put God can in front of it. And then it'll suddenly make sense. Lewis writes, nonsense remains nonsense even when we talk it about God. We can also point out that in the original design, God created humans to be almost universally free. There were no rules. They were created to be without sin. He only gave them one volitional opportunity to make a free will decision to choose against him. And at that point, they chose that. But if God created a world where it was impossible to choose against him, then that would not be free will at that point, which would make it complete nonsense. Well, another objection is, if God created free will and then free will led to evil, then didn't God create evil? Here's the way André Comte Sponville writes in his book, The Little Book of Atheist Spirituality. He says, true, human beings are often responsible for suffering and injustice, but who created humanity? Why would God have made us so weak, cowardly, violent, avid, pretentious, and overbearing? Michael Martin describes it. He says, indeed, humans constitute the most dangerous class of entities ever made, and their creator, it can be argued, should be held responsible for their actions. Well, we would respond that God is the indirect cause of evil, but he's not the direct cause of evil. The first cause for sin was a free will decision, not God's creation. When we're talking about free will, okay, actual free will, we're saying if someone's making a freely willed decision, that means they're responsible for what happened. If a free will decision brought sin into the world, then this was the first cause of sin. The buck stops there. It doesn't go any further. So to speak about a cause before the first cause is nonsense. That is nonsensical, to speak of a cause before the first cause. We can also point out that free will is a morally neutral faculty. It's not like free will is good or evil in and of itself. It's morally neutral. So think about it like this. Is an axe evil? Is a pen evil? Is a mind evil? Well, an axe can be used for evil. You know, well, you could use an axe to chop down a tree, or you could use an axe to chop someone's head off. What about a pen? You could use a pen to write a sonnet, or you could use it to write slander. You could use your mind to solve a crime or to rob a bank. Are axes, pens, and minds evil things? No, it's not the thing in and of itself. The thing in and of itself is morally neutral. It's the user of those things that's good or evil. That is who we trace it back to. When someone gets caught with a chainsaw chopping someone's head off, nobody ever arrests the chainsaw, okay? They arrest the person using the chainsaw. You know, here's a picture of a drunk driving accident. I don't think they survived coming out of that. I mean, that looks pretty bad, pretty terrible. Okay, when we look at this picture here, we have to ask ourselves a question. Drunk driving accident. Who's responsible for this? Should we go back to General Motors and say, well, you guys created the car, so you should be tried and put in prison for putting that car on the market? Now, if General Motors created a car that was defective, yeah, they should be tried and arrested for that. If they created a perfectly good car and a drunk driver got behind the wheel and killed themselves or other people, then at that point, it's their fault. It's not the giver of the car. It's the user of the car whom we find responsible. Well, what about this question? It would have been better if God just had never created free will. Okay. It would have been better if God just never created it because it led to all this mess. Well, we could point out that this statement is self-defeating. You're using your free will to make this statement. How can you make this statement unless you're using your free will? We could also point out that if God insulated humanity from evil, then this would also insulate us from the greatest conceivable good. Okay, if God hadn't created free will, we wouldn't have evil. But if we didn't have free will, we wouldn't be able to encounter the greatest conceivable good. I used to work with the mentally handicapped, people who are severely disabled. And I'm not making any kind of a statement about mentally handicapped people, okay? Obviously, they have a role in family and society and in our school system, all of that, okay? Not saying that. But ask yourselves a question. Would you desire your child to be born with a severe mental disability to the point where they couldn't even communicate with you, couldn't speak, couldn't express anything in relationship with you? Would you desire that for your kid? Well, of course not. Of course we would say no. Well, you have to ask yourself, wait a minute. If they weren't able to be able to express themselves in relationship, well, that would stop them from a lot of the severe agony that many of us have experienced. You know, they would never get dumped by a girl. They would never be not asked to a dance. They would never have to experience heartache, separation. You know, by being disabled, they wouldn't be able to experience a lot of the deepest sorrows that many of us have had to go through. It would insulate them from that. However, it would also insulate them from experiencing many of the great joys that we get to experience in life. So on the one hand, it would protect them from many things, but on the other, it would insulate them from a great number of things as well. Ask yourselves another question. If you have a kid, think about it. Your kid is going to grow up. Many of their sexual experiences are going to be pretty bad. Some of them will be damaged, assaulted sexually. Others will be in very difficult situations sexually. A lot of the human scars that we hold are from bad sexual experiences where we've been hurt, used, damaged. Would you want your kids to have their genitals removed so that they would never have to go through any of that? It would certainly solve the problem. They would never have to go through any damaging, distorting, aberrant sexual experiences. But at the same time, it would prevent them from experiencing a lot of great joy and pleasure, which God intended. So by limiting things on the one side, it would also limit things on the other. In the same way, this is what we're trying to say here. If God didn't give us free will, that would stop a lot of evil. True. But it would also stop the greatest conceivable good, which is coming into a relationship with the God of the Bible. That's the greatest possible good you could ever have. So by eliminating free will, we would eliminate that as well. Okay, let's pause there for questions. Do we have any questions on anything we covered so far? Yeah. Sure. So the question is, what about that objection where somebody says, okay, it was our fault, it was our free will decision, but isn't God all-knowing, and didn't he know that we were going to bring about all of this terrible stuff? Yes, he did know. Absolutely. He was omniscient, and he knew what would result. And yet at that point, God brought in a plan not to destroy evil, but to defeat it. And so at that point, we have to enter into not the question about the beginning of evil, but the end of evil, how God's going to tie this all together and solve it. And God has an option there, whether he just wanted to destroy all of humanity at that point, or if he wanted to let this thing play itself out for morally sufficient purposes. At that point, you'd wonder, well, what is the morally sufficient purpose for the Holocaust, for genocide, for murder, for tort? What could possibly be good enough that God would be holding back his hand? And we're going to have to get to that in a little bit. We've got to hold off on that. Yeah. Self-conscious. That's a good distinction. Thank you. Animals are conscious, but not self-conscious. They're responding to instinct, not to choice. So we have a case there where it appears that they're making decisions, but really what it is they're just responding to stimuli. To give you an example, okay, it would be like if you left your kid with a babysitter and you came home and your kid was mauled outside by a bunch of dogs. Okay. And you found out that the babysitter just neglected to close the door and keep the door locked to keep your kid inside the house. And then outside, all the dogs were mauling your kid. Who would you blame? Would you blame the babysitter or would you blame the dogs? What's interesting is the dogs did a lot more to hurt your kid. They actively, voraciously went after your kid to hurt him or her. But the babysitter just neglected to close the door. And yet you would find that person responsible. You wouldn't find the animal responsible because we don't think that they have the free will decision. They're acting on instinct, not on decision. So, yeah. Yeah. So the question is, how does atheism explain personhood, this idea that we're moral, we are free choosing, we are even aspects of us like we're artistic, we like to engineer things, we express ourselves in ways that are not just fitted for survival, but for art and beauty. I guess from their perspective, they would say that it's the appearance of being personal at base. I mean, at bottom, there's no explanation for personhood apart from a personal creator, and yet we're kind of playing as though we're personal beings, kind of like when you get a monkey and you dress him up in a suit and you give him a cigar. You know, they're kind of pretending to be high society. They're not really. They're playing that. And so humans are kind of social beings that evolved in a social way for protection and for fitness and offspring and that sort of thing, but really, at bottom, we're just animals. There's really nothing more. So we're dressing up, is what we would say. Yeah. That's a good question. So what about this point? You said that consciousness comes from the prefrontal cortex, and yet how do we know that didn't just evolve? Well, what we would say there is that it's not that the prefrontal cortex produces consciousness, as though the brain produces brain gas, and those are our thoughts. Instead, that's the necessary hardware for a personal spirit or agent to use in order to have thoughts. So if somebody gave me 20 shots of alcohol and I drank all of those here and that alcohol got into my system, that would affect the way I think, right? If my brain is being slowed down by a depressant like that, that would affect my thoughts and my ability. I wouldn't be able to drive home. I probably wouldn't be able to speak or move. I'd probably be dead. But if somebody came up and took a bat and hit me across the head and that caused brain damage, or if somebody has a stroke, something like that, our thoughts are dependent upon our brain, but they're not one and the same with our brain. To put that another way, our mind or our spirit uses our brain as a vehicle to produce thoughts. So if I was an acoustic guitar player and my guitar was out of tune, that would affect the way I'm making music. Or if I was a violinist and the guitar or the violin was broken, that would affect the music as well. But the violin doesn't produce music. The guitar doesn't produce music. But the musician is dependent upon that instrument to produce it. So we would just say that's part of the hardware that we use. And when our bodies expire, the soul will escape the body at that point, eventually to be reunited in a resurrected body. So, yeah. I don't know what to say about that because I'm not a Calvinist. I don't think that their position is solid, and I don't want to misrepresent their view. I've dialogued with a number of solid Calvinists. They're Bible believers. Obviously, it's not an essential doctrine or anything like that, but I think they have major problems in this area, and I'd rather not misrepresent their view. You should ask a sharp Calvinist. I know they have answers, but I just don't want to. I'd probably end up ragging on Calvinism if I answered that question. That's one of the reasons I don't think Calvinism is true. So that's a good question, though. I don't know what they'd say. You hear different answers from different ones. Some of them say that there is such a thing as free will. I don't know. I don't want to get into it.